Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Omaha actor John Beasley, founder of the John Beasley Theater and Workshop. He'll speak on the topic Blacks in Cinema and Black Theater. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, February 28, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Narosungu Chiwengo, Associate Professor of English at Creighton University.
Mr. Beasley will be speaking today on Black cinema and Black theater, a lecture which was made possible thanks to the generosity of the Assistant Vice President, Ms. Kim Manning of Creighton's Marketing and Public Relations. And I would also like to thank Dean Leger from the College of Arts and Science for coming to support this event. During a class discussion about Black cinema and theater, a student stated that they had never watched BET because apparently it targets a specific audience. I guess I should have used the title American Cinema and Theater to universalize this presentation. But what we forget is that those of us that are not central in the American filmic and literary history continue to see American history as ours, despite its particularity. Black theater and cinema, depicting the particular circumstances and experiences of Black America, has played an important role in universalizing the American experience. Ira Aldridge, William Wells Brown, Victor Sejour, Garland Anderson, Angelina Grimicke, Alice Dunbar Nelson, Jean Toomer, Langston Hughes, Richard Wright, James Baldwin, Lorraine Hansberry, Imamu Amiri Bahaka, and August Wilson, to name just a few, have highlighted the particular and marginalized experiences of Black America which enable us to understand the American experience. I'm particularly excited to have Mr. Beasley here tonight, because even though he stated in a conversation he wasn't coming to Creighton to speak about the histories of cinema and theater, he is part of this history, for he is among the few African Americans that have made it to the big screen and have created Black theaters. Mr. Beasley is married and has two sons. He's a recipient of two honorary doctorate degrees and has been recently named National Spokesperson for a new lobbying and consulting firm, Advocates for the Other America, working to elevate issues of poverty, economic development, and empowerment before the Congress and the administration. Before launching his career as a professional actor at the age of 45, Mr. Beasley worked at a variety of other occupations ranging from longshoreman, television producer, radio news director, announcer, and railroad clerk at the Union Pacific. He began acting on stage in high school and has performed on many other stages, including the Goodman Theater in Chicago, the Alliance Theater in Atlanta, the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C., and the Huntington Theater in Boston, where he won an Independent Reviewer of New England Award for the Best Actor in a Large Theater for his portrayal of Troy Maxson in August Wilson's Fences. He is also, by the way, the founder of Beasley Theater in Omaha, and they have plays ongoing, so I hope that you will attend those plays. His first film, The Mighty Ducks, was followed by Untamed Hearts and Little Big League, all done in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Later, he was called to Chicago for the television series titled Brewster Place to play the love interest to Oprah Winfrey's character. While in Chicago, he was hired as defensive backfield coach in the classic movie Rudy and also the movie Losing Isaiah. He subsequently landed a role in the critically acclaimed movie The Apostle, written and directed by Robert Duvall, who was nominated for an Academy Award for his role in the movie. Mr. Beasley likes to think that he was the reason why he was nominated. The Apostle opened up the Los Angeles films and television market for Mr. Beasley. He has over 40 films to his credit, including The General's Daughter, The Sum of All Fears, Crazy in Alabama, and Walking Tall. The television credits include Freedom Song, Judging Amy, CSI, CSI in Miami, NCIS, Boston Legal, Millennium, Harry's Law, Detroit 187, and as a regular and narrator for the WB series, Everwood. One of my students said, oh yeah, I love that particular show. I watch it all the time. He is currently in a recurring role in HBO's Tremé and as a series regular in the new TV Land sitcom, Have Faith, starring Cedric the Entertainer.
Thank you, and good afternoon or good evening. I just flew in from Los Angeles. I don't even know where I came in from. I came in from Washington, D.C. There was the inaugural fundraiser for a group called the Advocacy for the Other America, and as she mentioned, it's a lobbying firm for the to raise the issues of the very poor before the administration and Congress. So it's a pleasure, it's an honor for me to be here. I grew up not too far from here, 26 in Caldwell, and it's very close. As a kid, we used to come up here, and there was just the church there and some buildings down that way, some dental stuff. And I used to play around. They had a little goldfish pond down there. And I used to sneak into the stadium. I mean, the basketball center was right over here. I grew up around here. There was also a football stadium. Creighton had a football team, and I know you guys didn't know that. They had a football team, and I think they got rid of the team probably in the early 50s, but had a really nice stadium. And so we used to sneak in and climb over the fence and climb through the bars and play on the field and just have a great time. The Creighton was much smaller back then, but it was really a fun playground for us as kids. I never thought I would be here speaking before someone in this capacity. Coming up over there on 26th Street, it was a good time for me. Growing up in North Omaha was really pretty exciting. North 24th Street was the place to be. I remember as a kid going down the street and seeing buses with James Brown on the side of it by the Dreamland down there at the Jules Building and Ray Charles and B.B. King and all those people. They would come through here, I guess, because Omaha was kind of like in the center of everything, which it is the center of everything. And so traveling from Kansas City to Chicago or something like that, they would always stop into Omaha. It was a great time. There was music up and down the street. In fact, when I was coming up, I thought that I would probably be in a singing group, because any Friday or Saturday night, you could find us down on 24th and Lake, and a bunch of us would get together and a singing group would break out. And so I always thought I would probably be in a singing group, something like the Temptations, or I had a few guys, and I told them that we could be John Beasley and whatever they wanted to be. But I really thought singing was going to be the thing. And so I got to high school, and I did like to speak before the English class and the speech classes. And so the English teacher told the dramatic arts teacher that she thought I would be good on stage. And so he came and got me. And in those days, a teacher, you know, when they asked you to do something, you did it. And especially this guy, Mr. Roy, Kenneth Roy, he asked me to be in his play and to take his class, and I did. And Mr. Roy was kind of a guy, I mean, he was really funny, but he could change at the drop of a hat. And I got to learn his moves and everything. I was his favorite. He just loved me. He introduced me to oral interpretation of prose literature while I was in high school, and got me involved in the contest and the competition work. And I did quite well. I just really felt comfortable doing that sort of thing. But I never thought it would be, you know, my life. Until I got to college. I started at Omaha University, and I did a reader's theater because somebody had dropped out and they asked me to do that. And then I started getting the itch again, and I did a couple of other things. But then in 1968, it was a pretty tough time here in Omaha. There was a lot going on politically. There was a lot of police brutality. There was a lot of things going on in the neighborhood, and I became active in it. And at that time, I was run out of town, you know, and with, you know, threats to my family and that sort of thing. So I left Omaha and moved to Philadelphia, where I started, when I got into TV production at a station called WFIL at the time. It was WPVI now. It was the ABC affiliate. And I got a start there in the mailroom, and then moved up to associate television producer. And I really enjoyed it, because at that time there was a lot of people coming through, a lot of entertainers coming through. And so I got to meet everybody in those days, the 60s through the 70s, that was anybody coming through Philadelphia, from Sammy Davis Jr. to Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells and the Delphonics and everybody that was anybody. Even presidential candidates came through. Hubert Humphrey I met there. And so I was there for a few years, and then I got kind of bored, and I left, and I became a longshoreman. Now, that was a big switch, you know. I left here, and I went there, and there were a lot of tough guys there too, you know, hard longshoremen. But I kind of fit in, because I can get along with anybody. I fit in, and one of the guys, if you live in Philadelphia, you got to have a nickname. If you don't have a nickname, you're nobody. And so a good friend of mine, Sugar Bear gave me a nickname. See, everybody used to call me Red because of the freckles and everything, and my hair was a little red, and they used to call me Red. Some people call me Dirty Red. But Sugar Bear started calling me Pink Pad. And there was a commercial in those days, a SOS commercial, and there was this Brillo pad would come into town, and SOS would say, "You're all washed up in this town, Pink Pad." And so I became Pink Pad, and up and down the waterfront, every time I'd go somewhere, they said, there's Pink Pad. Hey, there's that guy they call Pink Pad. So hi, Pad, you know. So I got pretty popular on the waterfront. And guys, you know, just to call, "Hey, how you doing, Pad? What's up, Pink?" And so I became pretty well known, and I stayed there for a while. But a few years, I started getting the itch again. It was 5 years since I had been on the stage, so I decided that I'd try out for something. And I did try out for a play called As You Like It, and I got a part in it. And at first, I was reluctant to go to rehearsals. I don't want to waste my time on rehearsals. And they kept calling me, asked, "Come on, you got to come." So I decided to go to the rehearsals, and I did the play, and in a minor role, but I was the crowd favorite. So I kind of got the itch. So I moved back to Omaha, and I went to UNO, and I took an introduction to theater class. And the director said that the professor said they were having auditions for a play, Happy Birthday, Wanda June, by Kurt Vonnegut. And asked me if, you know, he said if there's anyone that wants to try out, you know, just come on out. And I asked him at that time, I said, if a black tried out, could he get a part? And he said, if the black was good enough. And I said, that's all I wanted to know. So I auditioned for the play, and I got a part. And after that, there was another director that was in the audience one night, and he asked me if I would take his class, environmental theater, voice and movement and that sort of thing. He said, because I want to do this play, The Bacchae, and I'd like for you to do this. So I said, fine, I'll do that. And so I took his class, I did the play, and that's when I discovered a lot about myself as an actor. He taught me so much. He taught me quite a bit. And then later on, there was a workshop, the Royal Shakespeare and Theater of London. The Royal Shakespeare Theater came to town, and I met this actor by the name of David Suchet, and he was the Hercule Poirot on Agatha Christie's Detective, the one with the mustache. That's David Suchet. That's my teacher. And David came in, and he put me in a play, Streetcar Named Desire, and I played Mitch. So I was getting a lot of roles around Omaha. I got quite a resume working here in college and in local theaters. So when I left here at the age of 45, it was about that time that I decided I really wanted to do this for a living. I wanted to do it earlier, but my wife at that time, the same wife I have today, she didn't feel as if she wanted to have any part of what it was, you know, to be an actor's wife, an actor's life, and that sort of thing. And when I look back on it, she was probably right. I stayed back here because I wanted to keep my family together. And we have two boys, and both of them are actors, by the way. One was in Contraband. It was out not too long ago. It was out recently. Poor guys. I don't know why they wanted to be actors. I tried to talk them out of it, but they decided that's what they wanted to do. And so that's what they're doing. But I raised my boys, and I don't regret that. But at the age of 45, finally, my youngest son was a senior in college, and I said, I just got to do this. And my wife says, just give me 3 weeks. Just give me 3 weeks, and if it doesn't work out in 3 weeks, I'll come back and I'll get a normal job. And so she said, oh, all right, okay, go ahead, go on, go. And with that encouragement, I thought, okay, good, I'll go. Within a week and a half, I was turning down work, theater work. But I did land a role in a play, The Boys Next Door, and a young Don Cheadle was in that cast. I ran into him later on in L.A. He was doing quite well now. But it led to some other things in Minneapolis. I went up there because I didn't have enough money to relocate. I commuted to Minneapolis. And they told me, if you move up here, you'd work all the time, because I started landing a lot of work, commercials, industrial films. I was making a living. I was making as much as I made at Union Pacific, and I thought that was pretty good money at the time. And each year it got better and better. But I couldn't afford to really move. This was my dream, not my wife's dream. I couldn't afford to move to Minneapolis, so I decided that, I would just commute. And once they got used to the idea of me coming in from Omaha and that I would drive up even in a snowstorm, I did total a car one time trying to get up there to a job. They realized that I would do that, so they said, okay, we'll work with you. And so I outgrew Minneapolis, and then eventually I got the casting agent came in from Chicago, and She saw me work, and she said, if I have anything for you, I'll give you a call. And so I get a call from her a few months later to come into Chicago and audition for this show with Oprah Winfrey. And so I go into Chicago, and I do pretty good. But this thing drags on for months, and they hadn't decided when they were going to shoot and who they were. It was between me and this other guy in Chicago. And he was the top of his range, as far as acting was concerned. This guy got hired for most of the work that came through until I came along. And so it was between him and me. And so finally I give the producer, his name is Reuben Cannon, a call. He's now Tyler Perry's producer. I gave Reuben a call, and I said, hey, Reuben, listen, I don't know if this is how it's done. I'm just a country boy from Omaha, but what's going on? So he said, well, you're still in the running. And so finally they brought me in for a screen test. It was me and Ernest Perry, this other guy. And we go in, and I'm sitting down there with Oprah, looking at Oprah, and I'm thinking, I got to impress Oprah or I'm not going to get this job. So I sat up there. We're sitting on the set, and they're trying to light it. And so Oprah's sitting right there, and I'm sitting right here. And then Oprah says, so how's the family? I used to sell chemicals, and I knew that was a buying sign. I knew I had her. So I was going to take it a little bit further. So I said, Oprah, I said, where did you study acting? Because you were really good in The Color Purple. And she says, I never studied. I said, well, don't mess up, because this is my big chance. She looked at me like I was crazy. But I got the job. And we went on to do 11 episodes before they canceled the series. But after that, I had gotten myself into Chicago, and then I started doing work at the Goodman Theater. I did a play called Riverview. That wasn't my first play. The way I got to the Goodman Theater is because the Chicago area opened up, I got called into this theater in Rockford. A director was getting ready to do Fences, and I always wanted to do this play. And so I was working on a project in St. Paul at the time for Nabisco, and I flew into Chicago because we had some shooting down there in Chicago. And I had to get back on the plane because I had to get back up to St. Paul the next day, you know, to finish the shoot. And so the director said he wanted to meet me. And so I said, well, listen, you gotta come to the airport, I said, because I got to go, you know. So he came to the airport, and I said, hey, listen. I said, listen, I don't like to blow my own horn. I said, but nobody can do this like I can. And I said, you know, in this business, if you don't toot your own horn, sometimes there ain't no music. And I said, but nobody can do this but me. And so I flew into St. Paul, got a call. He said, he wants you to do it. So I went in and I did Fences. It set records at the American Theater in Rockford. In fact, my picture was in the phone book that year in Rockford. And so they heard about it at the Goodman Theater, and they were doing another August Wilson play, Joe Turner's Come and Gone. And they wanted me to come in and replace the lead who had to leave. And so I came in there and I did that. But I went on to do, they called me in to do another play called Riverview. And Riverview is a park in Chicago that back in the day, it used to be the place where everybody went. But blacks didn't go there, except the blacks that worked there. They did have blacks on what they called dunk tanks. They had a tank called Dunk the Nigger. And so this guy that worked at that job made a lot of money. He made a lot of money, enough to send his kids to college. But John Logan, who wrote a show that was nominated for the Academy Award last night, it was, The Descendants. John Logan wrote that. He wrote this play, and I thought it was a god-awful play. It really was. But I did do it, and I did it and did have some problems at the Goodman Theater, and they told me I'd never work there again. But I did. Eventually, I did work there again. I came back to do another August Wilson production, and this was called Two Trains Running. And it's just come off Broadway, and it had in it Roscoe Lee Brown, the great Roscoe Lee Brown, an actor by the name of Paul Butler. And Lawrence Fishburne had done it on Broadway, but he was doing a movie called What's Love Got to Do With It. So they brought in this guy by the name of Eric LaSalle. This was before ER. So we're doing this run in Chicago, and it's had a really great run. And the great Lloyd Richards was directing the show. And August Wilson came in. So I had a chance to work with some of the legends in the business as far as that was concerned. To working with those two, it was just a wonderful deal for me. August Wilson, for those of you who don't know, wrote 10 plays, one for each decade in the last century, chronicling the movement of African Americans from the South and settling in the area of Pittsburgh. All of his plays, with the exception of one, which was Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, took place in Pittsburgh. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom took place in Chicago. To work with August and then to work with him again down at the Alliance Theater in Atlanta was just a great honor for me. But that led to and as I was in Chicago, eventually, and I'm still commuting to these places, with the exception of when the Goodman called me in, they wanted, you know, they would put me up on the Gold Coast, and you know, and it was really nice. And eventually, they decided though that they wanted me to come in as a loco, and I said, no, I can't do that. So that's when I stopped my association with the Goodman. We're friends now; we talk. But that was the last of the Goodman. But my film career started taking off. And so while working in Chicago, I got to the point where I felt that I had outgrown Chicago because I was getting all the work, and it got me to a certain level. There were parts that they were bringing in with the films when they came into town. But they would save some for the locals, and anything that I went out for, I was getting. But I just felt it was time for a change. And so I'm looking at this movie called Family Thing with Robert Duvall. And I'm looking at this movie, and there's a moment in that film that just drew me in when he confronts his father with this letter about a woman he thought was his mother. And, you know, turns out his father had raped this black woman. And, you know, he came out. He looked white, so they took him in. But that he had a black brother, James Earl Jones, around. So it was a great movie. And prior to that, I saw him in this movie where he played this hillbilly. He took in this woman who was pregnant, and he was so real and believable. I thought, this guy is just, man, I would love to work with this guy. A few weeks later, I get this call from an agent that I rarely use because I multi-listed in Chicago and in Minneapolis. If you don't know what that means, I listed with several agents because I always felt that, you know, there's no sense of me going exclusive with any one agent if they can't promise me anything. So, you know, maybe this other agent might get a call that he doesn't. And so this agent calls me and he says, John, they've been looking for this guy all over. He said, they've been through New York two times and been through Chicago. He says, I think you could do this. And so he said, I said, send me the script. And so he sent me the script, and I looked at it, and I said, they're looking for me. And he laughed. And I said, I don't know how they even knew I was out here, but I said, they're looking for me. Nobody can do this but me. And the reason I said that is because I was known in Minneapolis and in Chicago as a real person. I was real people. And I knew that that's what Duvall was looking for because I looked back at that film, that black and white film, and I saw this moment with his father. And I said, they're looking for me because I didn't know anybody else that was doing that. Morgan Freeman wasn't doing it. You know, Denzel, none of those guys were doing it. And so my agent said, well, put it on tape and send it out to Bobby and see what he says. So I put it on tape. I held it up for about 3 days, and then I told my son, I said, listen, let's send this out there. I had just finished doing Driving Miss Daisy at the Playhouse, the community playhouse, and I was told I'd never work there again. you know, I'm not that hard to get along with. It's not me. I was doing the play, and I was still working out of Chicago, and I had to do, you know, while we were going through rehearsal, I had to go up there and shoot a TV series called Missing Person. And I only had a day on it, but I had to drive up there and do it. And so they excused me from that. And so I told Charles Jones, who's the artistic director at that time, I said, Charles, I said, you're going to need to get an understudy. I said, because this is what I'm doing for a living now, you know. And so he said, oh, no, we don't do understudies at the Playhouse. Oh, no. So I said, okay. So then I get a call from Minneapolis. And so there's a movie being produced, and Arnold Schwarzenegger's in it. It's called Jingle All the Way. And then there was another movie called Overnight Delivery with Paul Rudd and what's her name, Reese Witherspoon. And they were young. And they just come off. They just came out of a movie called, what was that teen movie they did back in the day? Anyhow. So this casting agent had cast me in a lot of things. And so I couldn't just let her down. So I told her, I said, listen, I can't get out of this, so I'm going to have to turn Jingle All the Way down. She said, okay. She said, but, John, this other one, we don't have a plan B. I said, all right, I got to go. So I decided I was going to go, and then so I called my union, and they said, hey, just write a letter, give them 48 hours. You know, they know the rules. And so I did that, and Charles Jones said, you'll never work in this town again. And I said, Charles, I don't think my future is in Omaha Theater. Little did I know I would open a theater and be stuck here with it. So, I did that. But as I was working out of Chicago, though, the Bobby Duvall thing, I did send it out to him, and because I figured this guy was Hulk Hogan when he wasn't Driving Miss Daisy. And so I told my son, I said, listen, put it on. Let's take it about right here. We'll do a shot right here because I think if he looks at me, this guy was supposed to be in his 60s, had a couple of heart attacks. And so I made a career playing older characters because of my foundation here in Omaha. Some of the plays, a lot of the plays that I did, I had to play older characters. And so I had to make this guy, you know, look like he was, you know, could have had a few heart attacks. And I was physically in pretty good shape. So I said, just get this close up. So we sent it out to Bobby, and he says, that's the guy. He says, I'm going to come to Omaha to meet him. If I can't get there, I'll bring him down to Louisiana, and we can meet there. And I fly down there, and, you know, we hook up and just hit it off. He says, yeah, Big John, listen, hey, I got some ideas, you know, and I got this one shot. I want to get you from here to here. And that, and I said, yeah, that's a good shot, Bobby. That's a nice shot. And if you see the movie, if you ever see the movie, there's a really nice close-up of me right here and filling up the screen, you know. I think it's probably the scene that got him nominated for Best Actor that year. But But I knew I was going to get the part because I stole some of his stuff that I seen from this hillbilly thing. I stole that from him, you know. I borrowed it from him, you know. And then plus, you know, I, as I said, my thing was really believability. I learned that from my teachers. And how to go inside and as opposed to being what I call a head actor, I like to internalize it, you know, find out what the character wants and what the follow my objectives. And if you do that, I think it's hard to go wrong as an actor. You have to listen. Listening is the most important thing that an actor can do. And so I learned to do that, and it's served me well. So now they're flying me. They're giving me a limousine, driving me to the airport, flying me out to L.A., and putting me up in the Beverly Hilton and all this stuff, you know. And I said, I could get used to this. My first time out in Los Angeles, I was flown out there to do a pilot called ATF. I was the guest star, and I was the Secretary of Treasury, And I get killed in the pilot, you know. When have you ever heard of the Secretary of Treasury getting assassinated? Who's going to kill this? But no, I'm the black secretary, and I get killed. We're going to kill off the black guy. And that's the thing that I saw in the movies coming up mostly. If you've seen the black guy, you know the black guy was going to get it. Like black, I seen him kill off Samuel Jackson in Jurassic Park. And I got killed off in Everwood. I got killed off in the fourth season of Everywhere. They said, well, we're going to have to make something happen. What if we get rid of somebody you really care about? Let's get rid of the black guy. We like him a lot. So they got rid of me there. But it opened up L.A. for me, and I started working out of L.A. And, in fact, they told me when I was doing The Apostle that it would change my life, and it really did. It led to a lot of big film. And eventually, I was always following James Earl Jones as an actor coming up. Great White Hope, anything that he did, I thought, man, and he was getting the great roles. Denzel was getting a lot of roles. As I was coming up, Sidney Poitier was the man. He was getting all this work. They let one in, and Sidney was the man. He just happened to be the flavor. And Sidney was doing everything. He had some great films, you know, and so I had to go. I mean, he was the only black that I could see, you know, that we could see in the movies when I was coming up. So and Tony Curtis, you know, some of those guys I really loved. He was in some great movies. I never thought that much of him as an actor, and I know that's blasphemy. Don't say that in front of black people, but Sidney's okay, he's okay, and but I got a chance to work with him in Chicago. At one point, we did a TV movie called Blackboard Jungle, the English thing. It was black. No. It was. I forget what it was. Anyhow, I had to go To Sir with Love. That's it. Who said that? Yeah, To Sir with Love. It was the second one. It was called To Sir with Love Part 2, and I think it was badly written. And I got a chance to work with Sidney at that time. And, you know, I started to understand him a little bit more. But, I'm just really proud of the fact that, he was there doing really credible roles and things like that. He was somebody that we did look up to at that time. Coming up, there was no black theater in North Omaha. And I hope I'm not running too late. How many? Okay, 50, whatever, you know, and listen, I would like to, since it's kind of informal, because it's only 50 minutes, if you have any questions, please ask. I'd be only too happy to answer any questions that you have about anything that I've said. Yes.
Did you ever feel like you were stuck in the same role, or was that something that you chose to do? I know you mentioned playing older characters. Mm-hmm. Was that something that you did purposefully, or what? Did you feel stuck ever?
No, I did feel kind of stuck, and people would ask me, I would say all the time, you don't look as old as you do in the movies, you don't look as old in person. I started getting, I was getting typecast, but it kept me working. It kept me working in some very good roles too. I've tried to get away from it, and I think I have in some of my later films where it didn't call for an older guy. But the fact is that at this point in my lifetime, I am as old as those characters that I was playing. So you figure I should be working a lot. So, I did get typecast in a lot of that stuff. But they were very good roles, though. And always in a position of leadership or something like that, somebody that has dignity. And that's one of my requirements. I'll never play anybody that, you know, that you know, I can't justify.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Beasley, you just spoke of your requirements. Could you tell us some of the other requirements you have as an actor, and then why is it important as an actor in general to have requirements, but especially as a black actor?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, and I do keep, you know, keep my people in mind when I'm doing roles. I don't want to do anything that's embarrassing. But other than that, you know, all I require of a role is that it be a good role, you know, the writing be good, and that I, you know, if I can justify, you know, this character, you know, that's fine.
It seems to me that from your presentation, you've sort of highlighted the fact that it's been difficult for blacks to get into film and cinema.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would like to know why it's difficult and how blacks managed to get into cinema. It seems to me that you did it the traditional manner, but I'm wondering how other people have been able to do it. And then the second question has to do with stereotypes. I was reading an article today about Davis, who didn't get an Emmy Award. And in that article, they talked at length about the fact that African Americans in general only get stereotypical roles in cinema. So I'd like to have also your point of view on that.
You know, I don't agree with that, that much today. I thought Viola Davis did a wonderful job in The Help, as did my friend that won the supporting role. I've always been able to create a character that after you get to know this character, the color didn't matter. And I was able to, and I attribute my bringing up here in Omaha for that, because I was always the only black around, but I also happened to be the best actor around. And so I was getting roles even, you know, regardless of my color. And so it transferred over into my film work. But generally, you know, you don't, if a role in theater or roles in the movies don't call for a black, then they won't put a black in that role. So I've had to fight that. And I've done a pretty good job at it, but as a middle-aged black actor, you know, it gets harder and harder to get roles. And that's why I'm so grateful to August Wilson for what he's done. I mean, he's created characters that, you know, I can do until I die. And wonderful characters. So on the theater side, that's taken care of. The fact that I did Everwood. It did call for a black husband for Edna, and so you know, that helped me in that sense. But I think there was a gentleman here. I used to work at his theater here, and once my career took off, he said, "John, what do you owe to your success? Is it the fact that you're black?" And I thought, wow. I think it's because I'm a good actor, you know, and I have the talent and the gift that, you know, and I use it well. But he is one of the guys that felt initially that, you know, a black, if it doesn't call for a black, I'm not going to use one. And he had a very popular theater here, but there was an actress that talked him into letting me do this role, the role of a doctor. And I'm like, you know, blacks can be doctors, blacks can be anything, you know. And so he saw me in the role, and then he told me, he even admitted to me, he said, you know, at first I didn't know if this was going to work. But I try to make them see the man first. I did Streetcar Named Desire at Omaha University, and I played Mitch. And I'm the only black in the cast. And the audience loved the play, but the news writer, the columnist for the paper wrote, you know, no doubt John Beasley is a fine actor, but I can't get over the fact that this black man was playing Mitch. And so the letters to the editor really kind of ate him up. They, what's your problem, you know? Once the show started, you know, you forgot all about that, you know? And so, yeah, you do, there is that problem. But I don't think, you know, I see actors that do stereotypes, but I don't see a lot of scripts that are calling for that these days. For instance, I saw Red Tails. I thought it was, I'm glad the story was told, but I was critical of the actors. I thought Terrence and Cuba Gooding Jr. could have mailed those performances in. They were very stereotypical, you know, and unrealistic, unbelievable to me. But having said that, I'm just glad the story was told because I know it needed to be told. And that's why I opened my theater, because our stories are not being told. And what we're doing at my theater is our history. We're telling our history, the story of our people and our journey. And I like to do it in a very good way. I work with my actors and believability, and I think that they need to be able to bring a real passion in their soul to these roles. I've seen some black plays done other places, in other theaters, and just really I just hate it because I'm seeing white directors trying to direct black culture, and it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work for me. And what they do, too, is they take the passion out of the actors, too, so that they become palatable to their white audiences. And that bothers me.
In connection with what you just said and also a question that we were asked before, how much of you, like you talk about developing yourself and, you know, when you finally decided to, you know, take that step out there and just, you know, fully commit to this, what do you have to say about developing yourself inwardly in comparison to even thinking about the outward stuff? I was having a conversation with a student earlier, Simone, actually, about how if we focus more energy on inward resources, then the rest of it outside falls into place.
It'll fall into place. Yeah, it will fall into place. At first, you have to find what that actor wants and what the objectives are over the whole play, over the whole scene. You know, what is his objective? What does he want in life? And then I think you find out what that desire is, and then the emotion will follow. You know, you can't get the emotion first, but, you know, you've got to go inside. And what I do is I try to call up on, you know, my memory of, or, you know, I ask myself, how would I react in that given situation? How would I react under those circumstances? And then that's where I find the realism, you know, and the emotion and all that. And all that comes. I'm going to be doing a play in at the University of North Carolina next month. My friend Treat Williams is flying in. It's a play by Alto Fulgard, a South African writer. He writes about the effects of apartheid on the people. And so Alto Fulgard himself is going to be there. And it's just such a blessing for me to work with this genius. If you're not familiar with his works, he wrote Blood Knot, Master Harold and the Boys, My Children, My Africa. And I get to go in there and in a two-man show and work with this brilliant writer, director. So I'm looking at this screenplay, I mean, looking at this script, and I've got to find this South African in me. And so it's really an interesting journey for me, but I'm starting, because I'm finding the music of this writer, I'm starting to find, you know, the rhythm of a speech, you know. So, and that's what you do. Really have to do. You really have to find the rhythm, the music, in whatever you're doing. You know, you find that music in, and then you can sing that song.
Mm-hmm. Just out of curiosity, yes, you mentioned other productions featuring black cast in the local and regional area. Are you getting a lot of cooperation and feedback from any of that?
I don't understand the question.
Well, these other productions, I would think you'd be a reasonable person to consult or ask about how to set them up. Or you were talking about doing the histories. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm thinking right now of the one about the Western folks that was done at the Playhouse.
Right.
Is there any kind of crosstalk or relationship there?
No, there's not, but I didn't like what they did with the play. I think they took there was no relationships, and I thought that was very important there. I didn't see the relationship between those people, so you really don't care about them. I really didn't care about any of them. Phyllis Butler, who played one of the characters in there, I thought she gave the best performance, but she and I go way back. She was my first She was the theater was started around her. She wanted to. I'd always told her that I'd work with her at one point, and so I eventually gave her the script of Fences, and told her to look at Rose. I think one of the greatest female roles in literature, and I told her to look at that. And so I started working with her, and it got to the point where she got pretty good, and I thought I'd add some other people around her, and so I did that. And I always wanted to bring August Wilson to Omaha and show people how August Wilson is done and how beautiful this guy is, And so I started the theater with Fences, and she became pretty good. I put people around her, and then eventually Omaha Housing Authority owned the theater, and they decided they wanted to name it the John Beasley Theater. And I said, no, thank you. And I knew that if they did that, the onus would be on me to make it work. And that's the way it's been. They didn't give me any money. They just gave me a name. They gave me the building with my name on it. But I think that, once I got in it, and we're in our 12th season, I got in it and I knew that it was necessary to be there and to tell our stories. One of the problems that we have in the black community, I had the privilege of speaking at Blackburn Alternative School about a week ago. And I went to talk to some of these students, and they're sitting in the audience, and some of them, they're just hard, just terms, I'm not going to listen to you. And they sit there and they won't give you anything. So you have to figure out a way to reach these young people. But there were a few of them there that you could see that, maybe they were there, but maybe they could be helped and reached. And I did reach a few of them. Brought them over to the theater. They saw the show, and I had some comments back that, they would like to be in acting and do that sort of thing. So if we can reach one or two, it's worthwhile. And so I'll continue to underwrite it as long as I have to. I'm always looking for good board members. That's my biggest problem. So if any of you are in that, want to be a board member, I'd love to have you. But, you're going to have to work. But I think we're there, and we're serving a need.
John, I have the distinct pleasure of having known you for quite a few years. I remember at Tech High School, you were a year or two years ahead of me, and I think you did Invictus.
No.
You did something.
I did Freedom Song.
You mean verbatim?
A play.
You recited.
Oh, you know what? That was probably from God's Trombones.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Either The Creation or Prodigal Son or something like that.
Right. The Creation. That's what it was. And that's why, I admire you so much. You can remember all this stuff, and I have trouble remembering yesterday. But I digress a little bit. I was also at UNO.
Yeah.
With you.
Yeah.
And Marlon Briscoe.
Yeah.
And Marlon Briscoe, for those of you who know a little bit about sports, was also from Omaha, still claims Omaha, and was the first black quarterback to start as a quarterback in the NFL. And John Beasley has organized a group of folk to help do a film about the life of Marlon Briscoe.
It's called The Magician, and we hired Greg Howard, who wrote Remember the Titans, to do the screenplay. So he's written the screenplay for us. We're getting pretty close to getting that done. It's been a passion of mine because it's another great story, and I think the kids need to know about this, because the problem with our youth is that they don't know their history. They don't know their history, not even from the 60s or in the things that we had to go through to get to where we are today. They don't know that history, and they want everything right now. But a lot of these kids are coming out of group homes. I think, crack has had a big effect, and it's a shame. But as a nation, we're spending more money on policing and incarcerating our youth than we are trying to teach them skills to survive, but we're working on that.
I just wanted to know what role has been important to you personally or professionally, what role you have yet to fulfill in your career, and then, like, what actor or actress you would like to work with sometime that you haven't had the opportunity to work with yet.
Would you repeat that?
I just wanted to know, like, what role you've had that's been important to you, whether personally or professionally, and, like, what role you still would like to get in your career that maybe you haven't filled yet, and maybe what actor or actress you would like to work with, have an opportunity to work with.
My favorite role has to be that of Brother Blackwell in The Apostle. I also did a film called Freedom Song, which was pretty important to me because, as I was saying earlier, throughout my career, I was following James Earl Jones. And so when this role came up, it was between me and James Earl Jones. It boiled down to me and James Earl Jones. And James Earl Jones had was having knee problems. So it went on for a couple of months. You know, if James doesn't take this, you know, it's yours. And so finally he got a knee operation, and they called me in to do this thing, a really wonderful film called The Freedom Song. It was about the Freedom Riders of the 60s. And I replaced James Earl Jones in a role, and that was just kind of like, wow, okay. And then, you know, The Apostle, though, The Apostle kind of opened things up for me, but this was the Freedom Song role was a good role. I enjoyed doing Rudy. That was a wonderful time. But I've had a great time. When I did the Sum of All Fears, we shot in Montreal, and I'm sitting around a table, and there's Morgan Freeman, there's Ben Affleck, there's Bruce McGill, all the top character actors in Hollywood are sitting around this table. And I'm just like, I'm in awe. I'm just like, damn, I'm right here, man, with all these guys. So Phil Robinson, who directed Field of Dreams and also directed me in Freedom Song, was the director. He was married to, I forget her name. But anyhow, I tell Phil, I go to Phil, and I said, Phil, I said, I can't believe I'm sitting in the room with all these guys, man. He said, John, I feel the same way. He said, and you're here, too. Smile. So that was really important for me, but I think the most important I worked with some of the best actors in the business, so I don't really, there's nobody that I'm looking forward to working with, but I know that role is out there that's going to define my career, and I haven't got it. I don't know if I'm going to have to write it or what, but it's coming. I do have a new TV series called. Have Faith. It stars Cedric the Entertainer and Niecy Nash. And we shot the pilot. It's a spinoff from Hot in Cleveland, the Betty White thing. And the producers are Hazy Mills. They do Hot in Cleveland, Grimm on NBC, I think it is. And the new show, Have Faith, is a very funny half an hour. We start shooting in the series. The network TV Land bought 12 episodes, so we start shooting in April. We shoot from April to July. So this media is new to me. I've never done a half an hour sitcom with a live audience. We have a live audience, 300 people. We rehearse 4 days, and the fifth day we shoot before a live audience. I have done some Tyler Perry stuff. Tyler's not my favorite, but I did do a movie. I was in Atlanta, and I know we only have a few minutes. I was in Atlanta. I'm going to make the long story short. Reuben Cannon was down there. He was the producer for the Oprah Winfrey thing, and so Reuben is Tyler's producer now. And so I was in Atlanta, so I told my son, I said, give him a call and let him know I'm in town. So he calls Reuben, and Reuben says, listen, we're doing this movie downtown. He said, come down. I need to see you. Come down and see me. I said, okay. I said, I'll be down. So I go to breakfast. I get a call. Where you at, man? Where you at? So I'm eating breakfast. He said, man, please come down, man. I got to see you, man. I need you right now. So I go downtown, and we go to this courthouse, this abandoned courthouse where they've got the set at. And so they're shooting a movie called Daddy's Little Girls. And so I go in, and Reuben runs by, hands me a script. He said, look at that. I'll be back. And so he goes back. He comes back with Tyler Perry, and Reuben says, I'm going to be reading with you. I said, man, you're talking about writing now, huh? He said, yeah. He said, come on down. He said, just do me a favor, man. He said, I need this, man. He said, I'll take care of you. Don't worry about the money. We'll take care of you, man. But, you know, we've been trying to get this done all day, and the guy we hired, we just can't get it. So, listen, just if you do this, man, he says, I owe you. I said, okay, man, sure. So we read. Tyler walks out. He smiles and walks out. So they put a robe on me and take me into this courtroom. And there's Gabrielle Union. Wow. Gabby's from here. You know, she's a friend, and some other actors and actresses that I know. And so they announced that John Beasley will now be reading the role of the judge. And so there's a big applause and everything. So we rehearsed one time, and then they sent me to makeup. And so Gabrielle Union said that she, some of the actors came and she said, whoa, he just got here and he's in character already. She said, yeah, he's a professional and he's from Omaha. Yeah. so we shoot the movie. We shoot the scene. I get three scenes. We shoot it, you know, I'm there all day. At the end of the day, Ruben said, thanks a lot, man. So he says, they're going to give you a check. He gave me a check for $1,000. I'm like, what's the, I'm, okay, all right, that's cool. That's cool. But I said, I'll never do anything for Tyler Perry again. I mean, he really lowballed me. And so last year, I get a call from my agent and said, hey, Tyler Perry, they want you to come down and do an episode of, what is that show they got on? House of Pain. House of Pain. Come on down and do House of Pain. I said, no, I ain't going down there. I'm not going down there. And I got to thinking, now, John, you ain't worked in a couple of months. Now, my mother used to say, don't bite off your nose to spite your face. So I said, okay, all right, I'll do it. So I went down there and I did it. You go in and then you read the screen, do a table read, you do a quick rehearsal, you get in wardrobe, go eat, put up makeup, and then they go shoot it, and they shoot it in one day. I call it a drive-by comedy. You know, it's a drive-by sitcom. We had to work. We shot before a live audience on the sixth day for the pilot, and it took us 5 hours to do 22 minutes, and because we had a live audience, and the writers got a chance to rewrite some things that wasn't, if it wasn't working, you know, they were there. My scenes only took two takes. I'm going to tell you. I'm two-take Beasley. I come in prepared. I know my stuff, and I can make it funny. I think that it's an actor's job to make the writer look good, you know. So, I mean, if the writer gives you the words, you should be able to do something with it, you know. So,
what's the lesson in that, John, in terms of did you get as much mileage out of doing it for $1,000, or if you had to do it again, what would you have done?
No, the lesson there is never do anything for Tyler Perry again. No, okay. I am not working with Tyler Perry again. But that role, I'm looking for that role. Now, if you got any writers out there, you think you got something good for me, I'll take a look at it. Because I'm looking for that one piece. I know it's going to happen. I know it's going to get it. This sitcom could be my signature piece. I don't know, but I don't think so. Half-an-hour comedy.
Mr. Beasley, I had asked some people before you came if they knew Mr. Beasley. And the response was, yes, he's the man who does a lot of things in the community.
Oh.
Okay, the French say that none is a prophet at home. And so I would like to thank you for coming out here and telling us here in Omaha that we don't have to look to California, that we Omahans are it. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Omaha actor John Beasley, founder of the John Beasley Theater and Workshop. He spoke on the topic, Blacks in Cinema and Black Theater. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, February 28, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.